As you've been hearing all morning, the funeral for George H.W. Bush was held today at the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. He was remembered as a man of great character and decency. He listened to others, not only political allies, also opponents. But this isn't just a story of character. It's also one of context, not only of the times, but also of the Republican Party. And today, that's a very different party. Neil Milner's here to take the long view on that and do a bit of a comparison. Neil.
Hi. So I think that especially in times like this, and especially at a funeral when a great famous man dies, it's important to recognize the importance of his surroundings, the history in which he made himself. Because as important as character is, and as much as we like to think that our own powers of character and personality drives things, that's just an incomplete story. History is part of it. Context is part of it. And the thing to understand about George H.W. Bush is that the kind of success that he had and the kind of person he had, the kind of success he had and the sort of person he had politically, he could not succeed in this day and age. And one of the ways to consider that is the changes in the Republican Party since he was that really kind of started before, but had since he left office, what's happened to the Republican Party and how that makes it virtually impossible for someone like Bush to emerge as a real player.
And is that when you say someone like Bush, I think in terms of compromise. I mean, most
yes.
famously, it's the no new taxes, and that's the soundbite that sort of plays forever. But he did raise taxes. But that was part of the 1990 budget agreement that really laid the foundation for a stronger economy later.
That's right. And I want to be very careful here not to evaluate the policy success of what he has. I really want to talk about two things that are important to understand Bush in this context. One is his lack of ideological commitment. He certainly was a conservative, but he was a conservative that was much more common in the 60s, 70s, and even into the early 80s. And that's someone who saw himself as a problem solver rather than as an ideologue. And he also was willing to reach out because he was more of a moderate. And that's the first thing to understand about how difficult it is, if not impossible, to do that now, given what the Republican Party has become, both in terms of the public and in terms of people in the legislature. You have to remember two things now about the Republican Party. The Republican Party, people who claim they are Republicans over the last 10 or 15 years have moved much more to the right, are much more likely to identify themselves as conservative or extremely conservative. That's also started to happen with the Democrats to the left, but I just want to talk about the Republican Party here. And the second thing that's happened here is that ideology has become more important and purity has become more important. And that you have now what Bush didn't have is a series of strong right-wing social movements and the media, the Koch brothers, for example, and Fox News, that make it much harder to operate in a kind of moderate sort of way, to reach out and compromise. And another important change in the Republican Party is that it is now situated geographically and demographically in a way that makes compromise and moderation much less interesting to the Republican Party. And I mean that in a couple ways. First of all, the Republican Party is not at all like the country as a whole. And during Bush's time, it was much more. Demographically, it's considerably whiter, it's considerably older, it's considerably more conservative. And so it's different. The other way that it's different is that it's become a party that is much more regional. When Bush was in power, you had Republicans on the coasts in the Senate, on both coasts in the Senate. So what the Republican Party has become is really a minority party that has whose survival depends upon not reaching out so much, but maintaining this kind of base, this strong regional base in the south and a little bit in the mountain west, this ability to maintain itself. Now you wonder then, well, how does a minority party survive in that situation? Because remember, since 1988. All the presidential elections since 1988, the Republicans, even when they won, got the majority of the votes only once. So the Republicans have managed to survive on the basis of some gerrymandering, but also, and this is related to gerrymandering, but it's not at all just gerrymandering, the disproportionate number of Democratic votes in certain places, wasted Democratic votes has cost. All of these things then make a person like Bush less likely to succeed, H.W. Bush, less likely to succeed, and much more of a liability than an asset.
What about when that comes down to what used to be referred to as the pragmatism of politics, of working with Congress to get to achieve policy goals in the end?
Well, I think that the new pragmatism among the Republicans and also now among the Democrats, given the polarization, is the pragmatism is how do we hold on to our base? That's much more the case.
Survival.
Yeah, now survival doesn't depend upon moderation. Now, you're going to see a strong movement, at least on paper, toward moderation in the early stages of this Congress. There are organizations that are trying to push it. There are Congress people who are interested in it. But that's primarily the main difference. And I guess one way to think about this is to think about what George H.W. Bush said privately or semi-privately about Donald Trump and what it means in thinking about it in two different ways. He has evidently referred to Donald Trump as an ass. He'd been reasonably cordial with him. Now, you could see that as a difference in character. And in fact, I don't have any difficulty distinguishing between Trump's character and George H.W. Bush's. But I think the bigger point here is that Donald Trump seized power because he saw what the Republican Party had become. George H.W. Bush was what the Republican Party was. And you can see that in the lack of success that anti-Trump Republicans in politics and intellectuals have had in steering the course, and now much more agreement that the party has moved in a Trump direction, not because Trump created it, but because Trump saw these kinds of opportunities and went there. So that's a simple way to think about what happens if you think about this in character and what happens if you think about it in terms of these broader issues.
Part of that also, it's, I don't know whether salesmanship is the right word, but in terms of the idea of self-promotion, I was struck by Alan Simpson, one of his many great lines this morning, saying, those who travel the high road of humility in Washington, D.C. are not bothered by heavy traffic.
Well, I guess that's right, but the high road of humility isn't so high anymore. I mean, this gets less into my political analysis and more into my cynicism about what's happened in politics. It doesn't seem like it's cool to be humble anymore. That's not all the fault of Donald Trump, and that's the fault of a kind of general coarseness in our discourse, and has changed, and I could go on for a 24-hour telethon with that kind of thing. But I think that again, it suggests that warts and all, and H.W. had plenty of warts, did plenty of bad things as far as I'm concerned. The kind of person that he was in terms of humility, in terms of self-deprecation, just doesn't score the way it used to score.
Neil Milner, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Neil Milner, retired professor of political science and contributing editor of our segment, The Long View. You can find out more at The Conversation's Facebook page. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. In today's backyard quiz, we delve into the history of the Honolulu Fire Department, established at a time when the city was rapidly growing due to a large influx of whalers, businessmen, and missionaries. Outbreaks of fire became common as more wooden structures were built in denser spaces. Remember, there was no electricity at this time, so people relied on flames to light their world. That meant candles, lamps, or lanterns. In 1850, the HFD became the first fire department in the Hawaiian Islands and also the only department in the United States that was established by a ruling monarchy. In fact, it's believed to be the only one in the world that has had monarchs serve alongside volunteers. For today's quiz, can you tell us which royal was a member of Engine Company No. 4? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. First one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Kona Choral Society's annual holiday concert, Handel's Messiah and More, Sunday, December 16th, 4 p.m. at Sheraton Kona. Tickets at konachoralsociety.org.
The World Bank is putting more resources into the Pacific region. Over the three-year period ending in June 2020, the bank will nearly triple its financing across the Pacific to $825 million. That includes roughly quadrupling investments in the Marshall Islands and the Federated States of Micronesia. Victoria Kwakwa is the head of the World Bank for East Asia and the Pacific. She sees a series of projects in the region marking a new commitment to several areas in severe need of assistance. She spoke with us this week during a visit to the Marshall Islands and the Federated States of Micronesia.
We have indeed stepped up our engagement in the Pacific and within the Pacific in Republic of Marshall Islands and in SSM. I think it's part of the global development community realizing the specific constraints that small island developing states face. You know, they're very vulnerable to climate, they have a narrow economic base, and they have major issues with remoteness and connectivity. And they're not as able as other developing countries to raise the kinds of resources that are needed to support their development, and doing more to bring the financing to the table that will give them a better chance to improve their development opportunities. It also comes at a time when we all know that climate vulnerabilities are increasing. So it does make sense that these countries that are particularly vulnerable to climate get increased attention and increased support.
You know, you mentioned climate change, and the intensity of that has certainly picked up in recent years. Looking ahead with how the World Bank views this area, this part of the world, and what their projects are going forward, are you making adjustments based on the changes in climate change expectations? For example, some construction projects or some other larger projects that you might be considering?
Across the Pacific and in FSM, as you mentioned, we're helping them work on issues around climate adaptation. We're also helping them with the issues of managing their ocean, their fisheries sector, as you know, for several of the countries, including FSM, fisheries is a major provider of livelihoods, is a big part of the economy. And so managing the fishery sector in a sustainable way is really key to the sustainability of these economies. And we're working with FSM and others on it. We're also working on issues of connectivity. These countries are really remote. The land mass that they cover is small, but it's spread over a wide ocean area. You know, so the connectivity agenda, bringing small markets together and connecting them to other markets, is a major challenge and something that needs to happen to support them in their economic activities. In terms of what we're doing with on the climate, we're trying to make sure that everything that we do is climate sensitive. And particularly the infrastructure work that we do is resilient to climate. So designing, whether it's road infrastructure or even aviation infrastructure that can weather climate events, we're working with them as well to help them adapt and protect them from major climate events. So as we're changing what we're doing in that we're making sure that climate is mainstreamed in the work that we're doing more and more. We're learning more about how to do climate resilience across our portfolio of operations, and we're doing more on climate, more investments that would help them adapt and also help them turn to more renewable energy paths. We're working with FSM in the energy sector, and part of it is really around renewables. So yes, we are doing more on climate, and even in the existing programs or the different areas of work, we're making sure that our investments are more climate responsive and climate resilient.
We'll come back to the renewables in just a moment, but across FSM, the Federated States of Micronesia, when you talk about connectivity, and traditionally the World Bank aligns itself with governments, are you getting private sector assistance within this? Are you getting help and investments and commitments from the private sector in addition to government?
Yes. As you know, the World Bank Group includes the public sector agencies. We also have a private sector group, the IFC, and we work together in these countries. So there are IFC investments that can help generally bring more private sector participation in these countries. But even on the public sector side of our work, the way that we see it is that a lot of what we do with our governments creates the space for the private sector investments to come in. If the infrastructure isn't there, if the way that the maritime sector is being handled and what the public sector needs to do isn't being properly done, then, you know, you're limiting the possibilities and the opportunities for the private sector.
And when specifically you talk about the sustainable energy project in the Marshall Islands, I'm wondering in terms of, one, participation of the private sector in that, and also in terms of technology in moving ahead to battery storage, for instance. Is this something that is part of your blueprint there as well?
Yes. We're doing work in solar and solar street lighting. And that has to work with batteries. So the battery technology is something that we are using to bring and to increase the ability of countries like FSM to tap solar possibilities. And, you know, what we are doing, certainly the solar sector is an area where the private sector can be engaged. This is an area that we encourage our countries to open up to private sector and to see what private sector interest is out there to work in this area. But we are indeed bringing in the technologies which the public sector can help put in place the battery opportunity so that solar can and be rolled out much more effectively. In the country. it's just really the importance that the World Bank attaches to our partnerships with small island developing states like Federated States of Micronesia, and that we do have an opportunity to work with them on some of the very difficult development challenges. And I think our partnership or our stepped-up engagement is relatively new, but we're doing good things together, and we're focusing on strong implementation so that the resources that we bring to the table can really deliver good outcomes to the people of FSM and indeed people in the Pacific as a whole.
Thank you very much, Victoria Kwakwa, Vice President of the World Bank for East Asia and the Pacific, joining us from the North Pacific today, calling from the Federated States of Micronesia.
Thank you very much.
For me, it gives me a feeling of, I guess, belonging. I belong to a community, the HPR community now. The membership benefits, the gifts, of course, are nice and very well appreciated, but for me, it's just a sense of belonging and maybe even a sense of ownership that I'm part of this community and part of this movement.
Member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Radio with vision. Listen and see.
The Honolulu Rail Project is by far the largest public works project in the history of Hawaii. The price tag is currently more than $9 billion. Consistently tracking some of those budget numbers has been an issue, and one that continues. Civil Beat's Marcel Honore has a story out today that the board overseeing the rail project lost track of an agreement to reimburse the University of Hawaii for its rail-related costs. And Marcel, this could potentially be hundreds of thousands of dollars we're talking about.
Yeah, that's right, Bill. It's up to about, it could be as much as $600,000. This is a memorandum of agreement, of understanding, that was signed between the Honolulu Authority for Rapid Transportation, which oversees rail, and the University of Hawaii, because this 20-mile rail line is going to go through and incorporate the various campuses stretching from UH West Oahu and Leeward Community College, where the Rail Operations Center is located, and Honolulu Community College. So that they needed an agreement where HART would reimburse UH for all of its costs associated with reviewing and investigating how rail would impact its campuses. And that was signed back in 2014. Now, the problem is that it somewhere fell through the cracks at HART because it wasn't properly filed in their internal systems. It didn't make it to the procurement department. And so they basically didn't start a file for that contract and add that money to the budget. And it just came up recently. Sometime within the last six months is what HART says, and it kind of came to a head at a board subcommittee meeting yesterday.
And so, of course, one of the issues that raises is sort of, okay, what other missing documents or overlooked agreements might be out there within this process?
That's right, and they can't guarantee that there's nothing else out there. They said they've under the new executive director, that they've taken steps to reform organization at HART going forward. But as far as other things out there, they can't guarantee that there would not be some surprises. Fortunately, I know it's $600,000, which is a lot of money. But when you're talking about a $9 billion rail project, in the greater scheme of things, there have been, you know, bigger change orders and the, you know, multi-million dollar cost increases and things like that. But it still, you know, speaks to some of the legacy issues with HART's organization and management.
And I guess just, again, back to that word process, because at some point strategically you would think someone would say, right, how are we doing with the UH cooperation aspect of this? Because there are, I realize it's a complicated project, but that's part of the key, again, in terms of ideas of going forward and realizing that they can't guarantee that there's not more out there. But in terms of looking to reform the process that they go through, is that part of their discussion?
Yeah, so how it's been explained to me is that basically now everything goes through procurement so that you don't have this kind of issue, and that the problem before was that you sort of had the left hand not talking to the right hand. So even if certain people in other departments were aware of the UH costs coming down the pike, not everybody was in the loop. And so they've had audits and peer reviews. The American Public Transit Association did a peer review last year that really flagged a lot of the organizational issues at HART. And HART has, they've said, look, we've taken all these steps to tighten things up, and we have a stronger process going forward. So we'll see.
All right. Keeping track of that money. Thanks very much, Marcel Honoré. Every day
sure
we
thing,
bring you a reality check from Honolulu Civil Beat, today featuring reporter Marcel Honoré. You can read his full story at civilbeat.org.
Kupa Aina translates their name to simple island people, but there's nothing simple about their blend of traditional and contemporary Hawaiian music, chant, reggae, blues, folk, and spoken word. We welcome them back to the Atherton Studio on December 15th. Tickets to Kupa Aina at hprtickets.org, discounted for station members. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
November 28th used to be observed as a national holiday in the days of the Kingdom of Hawaii. Lakuakoa marked the day the islands were first regarded as a sovereign nation and began the kingdom's history of diplomacy around the world. On that day last week, the State Archives had one of its treasured documents on display. It's called the Anglo-French Declaration, and it officially acknowledged Hawaii as a nation with standing equal to countries like France and England. Wednesday was the 175th anniversary of the signing of that treaty. Catherine Cruz sat down with archivist Ronald Williams Jr. as he explained what that day and that document mean to Native Hawaiians.
Well, the exhibit was a celebration of the 175th anniversary of the signing of the Anglo-French Declaration in 1843, one of the most seminal events in Hawaiian history. That signing of the declaration by the Queen of England and the King of France gave Hawaii sovereignty and recognition as a nation. So prior to that, they could make deals and so forth, but they weren't recognized as equals. This treaty or this declaration was saying Hawaii is a equal to England, France, and so forth. That launched Hawaii's diplomacy across the world, where they ended up opening up over 100 councils around the world.
Yeah. And we just saw the exhibit open at the Honolulu Museum talking about King Kalakaua's world travels. This right. ties in with that.
It does, very much so. I mean, the treaty was in 43. Kauikeaouli, Kamehameha III, launched councils, started to launch councils across the world, but Kalakaua was the one who really kind of emphasized it and grew it exponentially.
And so tell us, what did you have on display here exactly?
Oh, so many fun things. We had the Hawaiian copy of that treaty, of that declaration. We had some of the original journals from the two men who went on the journey to try to gain that recognition. William Richards, a retired missionary, and Timoteo Ha'alalio, the first Hawaiian diplomat. He was a friend of Kauikeaouli's, one of the first literate Hawaiians. He traveled on this almost impossible mission to go gain recognition for his nation. He got that recognition, and he died on the way home. So we have his actual calling cards that were in his pocket. We have letters from him. And then we focused on Hawaiian Kingdom diplomacy. So we had council books and council letters and things like that from councils around the world. We had some from six of the seven continents.
These artifacts are something that people can access here at the State Archives.
very much so. That's, you know, that's one thing that makes us kind of unique is that we're a public archive. Private archives have certain rules. They can be open when they want and closed when they want. They have certain rules of access. Sometimes there's a cost involved because they need to make money to support themselves. But as a public archive, anyone can walk in and request to see any of the documents we have and are allowed to see them. Now, having said that, there are some of the most precious documents. We need to make an appointment so we can have an archivist there with you. They can turn the delicate pages and so forth. But there's nothing that we have that they can't see.
So this was the 175th anniversary of this treaty. Who came out for this?
Oh, it was wonderful. We had such a diverse crowd. We had education. We had the 11th and 12th graders from Halau Kumana, the local Native Hawaiian charter school. We had folks from the community, folks that you wouldn't necessarily see out at the archives a lot. I was worried because it was a working day that we wouldn't get many folks, but we gave a talk to start the day, and we actually had to close the doors. There were people demanding to get in. We had about 250 to 300 folks come through that two-hour period here in the archives itself. So it was a wonderful crowd.
Did you have a favorite document that was on display?
Well, I had a couple favorites. One of them was a map that one of the archivists here made up of the councils, the Hawaiian Kingdom councils around the world. You know, we say that Hawaii had a presence around the world. This kind of made it visual. She had put the addresses of the councils into a Google Maps count thing, printed it out, and so we had a world map with 117 pins in it. From Santiago, Chile, from Pretoria, South Africa. These were places where the Hawaiian Kingdom had a presence. So folks seeing that really made it real for them that the kingdom was present around the world. The other thing that I enjoyed was there was a case that we had that talked about the responsibilities of consulates. So, you know, some folks tend to think of Kalakaua as, well, he liked to parade around in fancy uniforms and have fancy dinners. And so you think, well, yeah, we had consuls. But what they did was protect Hawaiian Kingdom subjects around the world. There was a case that we had a letter from Port Townsend near Seattle. And in the 1880s, there were Hawaiian sailors who had gotten off a ship in Port Townsend and hadn't been paid correctly by their ship captain. The Hawaiian Kingdom Council in Port Townsend wrote the Supreme Court Justice in Washington and got their money for them. So it showed that they weren't just there for show. They were protecting Hawaiian Kingdom subjects around the world.
So this was a chance to really kind of showcase, I guess, the mission of the state archives and some of the treasures that you folks hold here.
It really was. It's, you know, there are so many incredible treasures here at the State Archives, and the idea that they're accessible to the public, I think people know it generally, but when they see something like this, it reminds them of some of the incredible sources that are here. Yeah.
And some of the artifacts that you folks hold were on display over at for the Kalakaua exhibit. I think folks maybe were surprised that exhibit included some of the things from here.
Yeah, the exhibit we held the other day were items that were solely from our collection. But in general, when museums, you know, do an exhibition like that, they'll include pieces from around the world. That exhibit that's going on at the museum until January 23rd, I believe, included things such as Walter Murray Gibson's diplomatic uniform, which is this bold, beautiful uniform sewed with gold thread, but that had a Hawaiian motif to it. And the idea is here are Hawaiians taking supposedly foreign inventions and making them Hawaiian to claim a place on the world stage. So yeah, some of the that vest and also many other items came from the State Archives.
And so you've marked this special day. It was a national holiday, and it was something that was really highly regarded in the Hawaiian community.
Yeah, 1843 was the signing. Starting in 1847, Kawikioli, Kamehameha III, asked his foreign minister to devise a way to celebrate. And he came up with, they were going to fire the guns at Punch Bowl, they were going to decorate the flag, the ships in town, and so forth. And from 47 on, it was declared a national holiday. So and at one point, it was a 10-day holiday, which would be nice. But there were grand luaus, there were dances, there were balls, and things around this idea of this tiny nation. One thing I think that is important to keep in mind is no other nation in Oceania, across the Pacific, gained recognition before Hawaii did. And Hawaii was the first non-European-born nation in the world to gain recognition. So, you know, way before most countries, this tiny little dot in the Pacific gained recognition as an equal of France, the United States, and everybody else.
Yeah. And that day that you had the open house, you also had little mementos that you passed out to folks that were here.
Yeah, those were kind of one of my favorite things. So on the 30th anniversary of La Kuakua, on November 28th, 1873, A group called Hui O Pio Pio, a young men's group, threw a grand luau on the grounds of Ioane Palace, Pohukaina, and they passed out formal tickets. We found one of those tickets in the collection of W.D. Alexander, and so we reproduced that ticket in its exact size and shape and color, and added our information on the back, and we handed those out, and those were selling like hotcakes, but they were free.
But it's you have so many treasures here, and I'm sure when you handle them, you know, they're probably very frail, but they need special care, and the fact that you folks can give the perspective and bring these artifacts back so that they find their place in present-day history. I mean, that's got to be very gratifying to the folks that work here at the State Archives.
It really is. You know, as I've only been here for about a year. Some of the folks have been here 3 decades or more. But I can, you know, speaking for myself, you never get jaded at feeling the mana in these palapala, the mana in these documents or artifacts. And so when you're pulling something out and you're, you know, I was looking at the Privy Council meeting minute books the other day from 1847, and I'm thinking, you know, this actual book sat in front of Kamehameha III, John Papa'i'i, David Malo, and others. To be able to you know, the archivists on staff are able to take care of those items, but actually once in a while to be able to show them to people and impact people's lives by knowing the history that came before is really rewarding.
Yeah. As part of that open house, you also, if you visited a gravesite on the premises here, talk about that.
Well, one of the first native Hawaiian diplomat in the kingdom was Timoteo Ha'alelio. He was a close confidant of Kamehameha III. He was actually Hanai'd into Kamehameha III's family. He was chosen as one of the 3 diplomats to go around the world and try to gain this near impossible mission of recognition. He didn't want to go. He asked the king, please ask anything of me but this. He'd never been off the islands. And this young man, young Hawaiian man, left Honolulu, Maui, and went to Lahaina, or went to San Francisco, sailed down to Mazatlan, Mexico. They took burros across Mexico for months. He wrote letters home saying we had to swim across this river and we were starving. And they make it to the other side of Mexico, travel up to New York, go down to Washington, go on to London, Paris, where they were successful in their mission. And he writes a letter home from London to his mother and says how much he misses her, that it physically pains him. And on the way home, he dies of disease. And so they return with his body. So, honoring that man, this man who literally gave his life for the saving of his nation, was one of our missions also. When we had a talk on his life, Mehana Hind from OHA, who was our cult, was our protocol person for the day, she led us out to his burial grave, which is just on the grounds of the palace, about 30 feet from that building. And there were protocol performed, not only by her and other experts, but folks in the crowd were able to come in and offer a lay or offer the lay that they had gotten or so forth. The students at Halau Kumana gave an oli for Ha'alelio. And so that part of it was kind of an extra special addition to the day.
So that connection is kind of, it's really priceless.
Yeah, it really was. And talk about chicken skin, you know, when you're watching this and being part of this ceremony, and then there's this eruption of 50 or 60 voices in unison behind you chanting an aloha to his name. You know, it was moving.
Very powerful, powerful story.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for sharing this with us.
Sure, thank you.
HPR's Catherine Cruz talking with archivist Ronald Williams earlier this week. For links to find out more about the diplomatic history of the Hawaiian Kingdom, check hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from Matson, celebrating the first of 4 new ships designed and built for its Hawaii service, and supporting HPR1's news coverage from around the world. Matson.com.
Early Earlier in the program, we told you about the history of the Honolulu Fire Department. By the mid-19th century, numerous wooden homes and businesses had been built all over the city following the influx of whalers, missionaries, and businessmen. There's no electricity at the time, so people would light up interiors with controlled flames, like candles and lanterns. Unfortunately, sometimes those flames got out of control. King Kamehameha III saw the need for a municipal authority to help combat the problem and issued an ordinance on December 27, 1850, that established the Honolulu Fire Department. A few months later, Alexander Cartwright Jr. was appointed the city's first chief engineer. The HFD holds a few distinctions. Not only was it the first fire department in the Hawaiian Islands, it's also the only one in the world to have had kings serve as active members. First, there was Kamehameha III in the 1850s, and then King David Kalakaua, who was a member of Engine Company No. 4 during the 1880s. And we had a winner, Carter in Chinatown, who actually created her own historical walking tour about the Queen, which is why she knew the answer to this one in particular. Also, someone else who knew the answer, a longtime friend and former host of The Conversation, Chris Vandercook, calling in this morning. And thanks to both of you. But Carter gets the tote. That's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Surfing and cooking might not seem like two activities with much in common, but a new book is challenging that notion. It's equal parts cookbook, photography exhibit, and memoir. It's called First We Surf, Then We Eat, and the author is Jim Kempton, the longtime editor and later publisher of Surfer Magazine. He's in Hawaii as part of his book tour and stopped by the Hawaii Public Radio studio for a chat with HPR's Ryan Finnerty.
First We Surf, Then We Eat was sort of in a way, a lifelong project. I loved surfing and been surfing since I was 10. I learned to surf on Guam, where I was born, and so traveled in the South Pacific with my folks when I was younger, and all through Southeast Asia and the South Pacific. And so I probably tasted a lot of food that was not what your average American would have tasted during that same period, and so kind of got introduced to more exotic food there. And then when I went traveling on my own, through Europe and Asia and Australia and Indonesia. I love to eat. My parents were both cooks, so I love to cook. And I just find recipes that I really loved or food that I really loved, and I would either get the recipe or have the people teach me how to cook it. And slowly over the years, I built up a whole set of recipes, and I thought if I put stories with them that were from these different places in the world, that it would make an interesting read for people.
Do you think you got the interest in cooking from your parents?
Mostly, although, you know, it's I think it's something that you just have an aptitude for, too. It was one of those kinds of things that I could learn really quickly. And I enjoyed doing it. There was a process there, and there was an immediate result. It wasn't like you worked for hours and then maybe someday you'll use it. It's like you work for an hour and then like you get the reward immediately, and it's fantastic, you know?
My experience has been that people in the up-and-coming generations don't cook so much, and they, you know, there's all these services where you can subscribe to, and they'll send you ingredients with a recipe, and it really kind of takes a lot of the brain work out of it. What was your experience growing up? Was there an interest in cooking amongst your peers?
You know, it's kind of twofold. In one way, I think we do have a lot more of that, a lot more packaged products, et cetera. On the other hand, I think there's a huge foodie movement with travel and ethnic kinds of foods that have been, you know, that have first been introduced to the United States now over the last 10, 15 years that are really, really unique and very exotic. And there's a huge thing that's gone with sort of the wine and the craft beer program. So, you know, food that goes with those things. My book has a whole set of cocktails from each of the different regions as well. And basically the book is, you know, it's 10 chapters. Each one is a region of the world. And then inside that chapter are stories about traveling and surfing and adventure in those places. And then each story is followed with a recipe. So from a standpoint of, like, I think there's a real revival and a real kind of explosion of what I would guess I would call sort of really, really good food cooking and people who are totally passionate about it. And that's growing very rapidly.
In reading the book, I was struck by the fact that it's as much of a memoir as it is a cookbook. And to label it a cookbook would really be to do it a great disservice.
Well, you know, I didn't set out to do it that way, but in telling the food stories from all these different places, it kind of ended up being a memoir, and that was really fun. It was, you know, there are a lot of stories that have to do with other surfers and other places and paying respect and dues to all the people who I learned from.
Surfers are kind of notorious storytellers, I would say. And do you have any stories from the book that stand out to you? Maybe you could share one with us.
Well, you know, there's one from right here in downtown Honolulu. There's a guy named Buzzy Trent, who was a big wave rider, really, really amazing. His famous quote was, you know, that waves are not measured in size, they're measured in increments of fear. And that's a quote that's been used over the years. And, you know, Buzzy was working on the high-rises that were being built in the 60s that are now all the hotels that we see here now. And he was up on the 11th floor and putting the steel girders in. And a guy on the other side had picked up a girder and it had swung around and hit Buzzy in the back, knocked him off the 11th-story ledge. And on the 10th story, he was able to, like, grab the thing, but he couldn't hold on and broke. Went down another story to the 10th one, you know, kind of clambered, absolutely locked onto it, pulled himself up, walked across the beams on the ninth story, took the elevator down, went down, got his plate lunch, took the elevator back up, cracked the guy in the head who had hit him, and then sat on the girder and ate the rest of his lunch. So the recipe for that was the plate lunch that he ate, which is, you know, the great Hawaiian meal.
I guess that was in the pre-OSHA days.
That's right.
That was one of the things that struck me about the book was it's not a conventional surf book. There's great surf photography and the stories involve well-known surfers or your own personal stories, but they're not all surf stories. Some of them are like that. There's another one, Cafe Haleiwa, the well-known restaurant on the North Shore, where the two brothers that owned it invented a new type of board that is kind of a cult favorite in the surf world.
Yeah, you know, Duncan and Malcolm Campbell invented the Bonzer, which was a three-fin surfboard that was designed years before Simon Anderson first made the tri-fin thruster. And they did not get the credit that they deserved, although they are now in later years as history goes on. And when he came out and started his business out here, it was completely for the surfers on the North Shore. And it's been a 30-year lineage there and a fantastic place to go and have breakfast.
And your time in the world of cooking was not just for fun. You were in the restaurant business yourself as well, right?
So when I left Surfer Magazine, I was the editor and then the publisher of Surfer Magazine. And when I left, I started a restaurant, mostly because I wanted to restore the building that it was in. But my partners demanded that I be part of the restaurant. And it was a pretty fascinating experience. And I learned a lot about cooking, obviously, and a lot about people and how to make them enjoy food during that time.
What made you want to pair cooking and surfing for this book?
Well, partly because they're two of my passions, but also I think it's the first thing that guys do. It's like the second thing they do after surfing, right? It's like first you surf, then we eat. That's why I titled it that, because almost everyone, when they get out of the water after a great session, that's the first thing on their minds.
There's a quote in the book from in one of the forewords from one of your friends about you. This is Steve Pesman, and he said, "Jim has had the charm tendency to fall into really cool gigs," and it's kind of at face value that does seem to be pretty true. Would you agree with that?
You know, I've been probably one of the luckiest people in the world, not only with my gigs but just with my life in general. My wife and my family, and you know, I've been married for 38 years and have three wonderful kids that are all adopted. So I've had a great lot of luck in life. And yeah, I worked for Surfer Magazine, then I worked for Trans World Publications, which was Surf, Skate, Snow. Then I worked at Quiksilver for a number of years on the Crossing Boat, which was an exploration vehicle, that surf exploration vehicle that traveled around the world looking for new waves. And then I was at Billabong as the media director for 4 years. For 10 years. So, it's been a lucky run.
And in all those travels where you compiled all of these different recipes, do any of them stand out as your favorite?
You know, I guess people ask me that a lot, and it's really hard because each one has its own kind of background and value to it. But I'm always drawn food-wise to the Basque Country, which is the area of France and Spain on the Atlantic coast. It's got fantastic food. It's got unbelievable waves and a really high standard of living. And when I was younger, lots of beautiful women. And it was a really fabulous place to live, and I learned, that was sort of where I learned to cook probably most of the stuff that I had. And you know, there's no better people to learn from cooking than the French, and the Basques themselves have their whole unique culture, and cooking is a big part of theirs as well.
You're in town not just for the book tour, but you have another event going on as well.
Yeah, Billabong is underwriting an exhibit that I'm doing at the Turtle Bay Resort. Every year when they do the Pipe Masters, which is coming up in a few days, there will be an exhibit there called Ohana, Great Hawaiian Surf Families. And it's going to be it's just going to be an honoring of the Hawaiian surf families that have really changed the face of surfing and are, you know, sometimes second, third, and fourth generation, all of whom have really made their mark on the surf world. The other thing that I'm doing while I'm here is going to Maui for 4 book signings, and one of them will be at the Kahula Brewery, and that's going to be on Friday night, the 14th of December. Love to see all the people on Maui. We're going to be doing some 3 other places that are going to be public libraries. You can find out all about it when you go online, but that's going to be really fun, and we hope you all can come to that.
Jim Kempton, author of First We Surf, Then We Eat. He'll be doing talk story and book signing events on Oahu and Maui, as he mentioned. To find a list of dates and locations, hawaiipublicradio.org. That's it for today. Up tomorrow, the business of bike sharing. You can tell us what you think or suggest a story idea. Call our talkback line. Leave us your comments. Here's the number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find us on Facebook at The Conversation or Twitter at HI Conversation. This show and all past ones available on The Conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Bill Dorman. We'll be back tomorrow, and so will Catherine Cruz with more of The Conversation.